I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share.
And Grand Rising, and welcome to Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. You're listening to KPFK. And this week we have a revolutionary roundtable, which I'll introduce in a moment. But as you know, we always start with, we need your help to support KPFK. We want you to go on right now to kpfk.org or call 818-985-5735 to give a good contribution to KPFK to keep revolutionary shows like Voices from the Frontlines on air. Today, we're just sitting around the table and having a conversation, and you're here with myself, Channing Martinez, co-host, Eric Mann, our other co-host.
What's happening? Good morning, Channing.
Mona Lottie Walker, our organizer in training and bookstore manager at Strategy and Soul.
Hi, Channing.
And Erin Aubrey, who is a writer and journalist in South LA.
It's great to be here, Channing. Thank you. And it's Erin Aubrey Kaplan, just...
Very important.
Absolutely.
No, really, Erin Aubrey Kaplan.
I have three names, I'm sorry.
No, it's a good name, and you told me a lot about your late husband.
Yeah. But it's great to be here. It really is. I'm excited.
Well, Erin, I've known you for a long time now. You know, you are a reporter for the LA Weekly, and you did a really great story about the Bus Riders Union at the Strategy Center about 73 years ago. It was great when we were kids.
Yeah.
And no, it must have been 25, at least 25 years ago.
Was it?
At least.
Many political eras ago.
Many political eras.
Yeah.
And then you went on, I know you did op-eds for the LA Times, and now you're doing, among other things, articles for Politico. So much to talk about. I wanted you here because you're just a really interesting person. I really like talking to you about, we'll just make it up as we go along. But let's start talking about your dad, Larry Aubrey, because he and I were friends and and colleagues, and I was telling my wife Leanne that he was one of the interesting, he was like a black radical intellectual. He wasn't, he was in a lot of different fields, his mind went many different places. He wasn't just the black community in South LA, but he was like a black Renaissance man. So tell me about your dad and tell me what it was like growing up with him.
Wow. Well, that's a good way to describe him. I think you're the only person who's described him that way. But I guess I'll start with the last part of your question. So growing up with him, actually, I didn't know what he did. I was a kid. I knew he did very important work. This was the 60s. Right. I was, you know, born 62. And I had a great sense that he was doing something, you know, impactful and important, but he really didn't bring it home. He didn't talk about it with us, the children. There are five of us. And so I just kind of listened and kind of figured out what he did. But I remember when I was a kid thinking, oh, you know, when we had show and tell day, why couldn't my dad be a plumber or something? So I could, like, you know, tell my mother, I used to ask my mother, what does daddy do? And she'd say, he goes to a lot of meetings. So I thought he was a professional meeting goer because he did go to a lot of meetings.
Right, that's right.
And he was constantly taking notes on yellow legal pads and had his briefcase, took a briefcase everywhere with him, even to Dodger games. I'll never forget that. he'd sit out in the bleachers with his briefcase. But I think all of his activism, and it took many forms, right, started... with an experience in Los Angeles. He's from New Orleans. My whole family on both sides is from New Orleans. But he moved here in 1941. Or 42, right after the war started. And so he's pretty much in L.A., not an L.A. native, but a naturalized L.A. citizen, but he went back and forth a lot. But he went to high school at Fremont High School, which was, right, at the time, this was the late 40s, predominantly very white, but it had just started to open up the restrictive housing covenants that kept black people out of many neighborhoods of L.A. had been struck down. His family lived just north of Slauson. And south of Slauson was like, you know, dividing line. That's where whites lived, and you didn't go there. But then it started to open up, quote unquote. My uncle moved to a neighborhood just across Slauson in South Central and immediately got a cross burned on his lawn. So my father, you know, when he was 14, was going to go to Jefferson High. Like all the black kids went to Jefferson because, you know, that's where they went. My grandmother said, no, you should go to, you know, Fremont. It's opening up. This is progress. This is somebody's got to go first, you know. And he didn't want to go. He knew what it would be like, but, you know, he went. Uh-huh. And it was a really, I think it just galvanized him, and it was terrifying. He said he ran home from school every day. And on the first day of school, when he and a handful of other kids, black kids, showed up, there were parents on the front lawn. There were hanging tar babies in effigy. You know, it was like Little Rock. But right, it was Los Angeles, 1948, I think. So that experience, I think, he never said it explicitly, but listening to him as he, you know, over the years, that is really what kind of set him on the path to just getting involved in movements for racial justice first, but justice in general.
Well, you know, the number of people who have been, number of black people who have been through just about every single experience about, we just were meeting with our friend, my old friend, Prexy Nesbitt, who's a great Pan-Africanist, and his family grew up in Chicago, and they were all educators, and they were the first people who moved into a white area and paid the price for it. And, you know, today, that's why 62% of the white people vote for Trump, because they haven't changed, you know.
No.
And
well, at least we know more about the history of redlining, and, you know.
Yes, it's very important.
I would say that people now are more aware of this history than at any other time in my life. I always felt I had explained this to people, but people may have rejected, but I think people in general are more aware of that, and, you know, and other kinds of racism. They may not want to hear it, but we are, it is in the conversation now, so that is I guess progress, right?
Yeah, I just remember, go ahead, Jenny.
Well, I mean, to interject here, because I met your dad through Crenshaw High School, and he would be coming to meetings,
yes,
awkwardly enough. And it was around the reconstitution of Crenshaw, but I say that because you know, it's due to the work of folks like your dad, like Eric Mann, like Barbara Lahan, so many folks, of talking about these issues. Because when you say people know about it now, you know, when I was going to Crenshaw High School, most of the curriculum wasn't talking about any of that.
Sure.
It wasn't until we went into coalition meetings around keeping Crenshaw open that we learned, you know, the whole reconstitution subject is all about trying to close black communities, and learning that, you know, LAUSD schools were never meant for black students at all.
So, I don't think any school districts were meant for
people.
But absolutely.
Somehow we have a different idea of Los Angeles, or many people do. They just don't think that happens here. But my father always said, too, he said this is like, you know, one of the most segregated city that he'd been in, and he'd been here a long time. So, but people resist, you know, for all kinds of reasons, they resist that reality. But I think, you know, the good thing about, you know, the George Floyd moment in 2020 is people say, oh, it's over and we're past that. I don't think that's true at all. I think it's permanently opened some doors. And I have to say, you know, I'm envious. You learned this when you were a teenager in high school. I actually didn't. I had AP history. I didn't learn, there's none of that in sort of advanced history. And I learned it at home. I learned it listening in on my dad's conversations, on my, you know, the story of the elders around me, And my father constantly told stories. My mother told no stories. She left the South behind. But my father kept telling stories, and I kept putting things together. But people from the South didn't easily talk about this. That's another part. That's another thing that I came to realize. They weren't so eager to talk about just things that had happened and things they endured that were normal, frankly.
Well, what radicalized you? I'm always interested in a person's journey. Mm. Like, you have one point of view, you think it could be anything. I don't know what started with an integrationist view or upwardly mobile view or something. And then something hits you upside the head and says, wait a minute, this society is not the way I thought it was.
Yeah.
Do you remember either the book, the film, and the direct experience that made you more radical? You know, besides your dad, what changed your mind?
Well, thank you for thinking of me as radical. That's a great compliment. Sometimes I struggle with not being radical enough, you know, because the times keep demanding more, right?
Yeah, that too.
But I would say, well, first of all, I read a lot when I was young. But what really, those moments you're talking about, that didn't come from books. It actually came from two experiences. One, when I was 9 or 10, I went to a neighbor. You know, we grew up in South Central near Century and Van Ness, in that neighborhood near Washington High School. I went to my local schools, and then when I was in fifth grade, this is like 1971, 72. I was bused to a school in Westchester, which physically isn't that far, but it felt like a whole other place. And I went there allegedly because they had a gifted program for kids, and they had it in my neighborhood schools, and somehow I don't know what happened. They just didn't have it anymore. So I went to this all-white school, which was a big shock, frankly, and something I wasn't prepared for. Anyway, but that went okay. But there was one day when I made a friend at school, a white girl who lived in the community, and I stayed after school, which I hadn't done before. And I get on the bus and go home. But this Friday I stayed, and we went down the block to visit another friend of hers, a friend of ours in class, a classmate. And when we got to the door, when we knocked on the door, the classmate opened the door, looked at us, let my friend in, but I was standing outside. She would not let me in. And my friend Lisa told me later, looking very regretful, but she said, well, you know, Lisa doesn't, they don't let niggers in her house. So I felt that was I knew this thing happened. I'd heard about it, but I was really shocked that it had happened to me. And I didn't, and I remember not even telling my parents because I felt somehow I had caused this that, you know, that's actually my first feeling. People, you know, I didn't have the sense to get angry, I guess. I thought, I've ruined a good time, or, you know, something about me that was wrong. And this is the internalized, internalized
depression
that we were talking about before we came on air. And so I kind of so I'll tell you one thing. I thought at that point, well, I thought I knew white people. I guess I don't. But then later, so flash forward, you know, when I was a grad student at UCLA, this was 1985, I was doing a degree in theater. And it was mostly performance degrees, an MFA, but there was an academic component, and I had to turn in a term paper. I did. I was very used to doing that. I was been an English major as an undergraduate, but the professor accused me of plagiarizing the paper and said, I can't grade it because obviously you plagiarize it because it's too good. And then again, I was kind of stunned. I guess I was sort of thinking, I knew better, but part of me thought, you know, if you follow the rules and you dot all your I's and cross your T's and you do everything right, that it would be okay, that counted for something.
Right.
But I was being told that I had done something, again, done something wrong by doing something right. And I was, that's what really got me, you know, I guess what you radicalized me. I thought, okay, this is not a just society. This is a liberal institution. You know, this is not the South. And this really does happen. And I had to fight for my grade, which, by the way, I ended up getting an A. But the professor gave it to me very reluctantly. Did not, and probably to this day, does not believe that I wrote it. Because things like, you know, I guess black people aren't capable of sophisticated thought. But, and the irony is for me, it was just a run-of-the-mill paper, something I did
Right.
I mean, not to, I'm not boasting or anything, but it was not something extraordinary to me. But, and I've often thought after that, you know, if that professor had had the right response and said, you know, Miss Aubrey, you have a lot of ability. Maybe I can help you or I can support you. That the opposite happened. And so even though, you know, I like to say I won the battle, but I lost the war. And that war is still going on, like you say.
Thank you for this. You know, every time we talk about it, these stories are so painful. You know, I do empathize a lot. And
it's disappointing.
Yeah, and it's the thing about the, I mean, here I am as a Jew, but I've been in the black community so long that in all my friends, they sort of had this thing where for a minute, they forgot they were black. You know, they were just walking down the street, just for a second. Just for a second. I mean, they knew it, but, and from that split second, they go after you, you know what I mean? Just when your guard is down, you think, well, I know I'm black, but I just wrote this great paper, and they say, no. You're always going to be demeaned. And
yeah, and you know, it was, you're right. And I felt like, and I remember thinking, I'm never going to let myself be open again because I really considered the professor an ally.
So painful.
Because in class, we would talk. I was actually the only student who was interested in that class. And the other people were just, they were actors and dancers, and they were like, they just suffered through. I was more interested in the writing, which was a clue to what I should have been doing anyway. But I really thought we had an understanding that we, you know, that he, you know, and I thought, again, I misjudged it. I completely misjudged it because underneath it all, I, you know, realized that, you know, for a lot of white people, it's just a matter of time before that racism comes up. I don't want to sound pessimistic, but that has been my experience. That you think you know someone and you do have a connection and then something comes up. It could be affirmative action, or it could be your paper, or it could be critical race theory, or whatever. And all of a sudden, you find yourself constantly assessing and reassessing, and it makes for a certain instability all the time. But you're right; those experiences are painful, and they stay with you. And I believe that those experiences stayed with my father, too, even though he was pretty tough. You know, he was pretty tough, but...
Well, you know, I call it the gift of oppression because oppression is a consciousness raiser.
Yeah.
You know, it's a small thing, but I shouldn't say a small thing. You know, I was in high school and I was forced to join a Jewish fraternity because I was with all these white people, I thought, and I was a ball player, and I was most of the people I played with were like Italian and Irish, and I, you know, so we got into high school, and they had all these fraternities. It was an almost all white school, and I go, oh, great, I'm going to get in the fraternity. He said, well, I want you in, don't get me wrong, but the bylaw says you can't, there's no Jews, and so I joined a Jewish fraternity. And then when I went in, they beat me up. The guys I knew.
Like and hazing?
Spit on. No, no. I'm talking about you, Jew.
Oh, my
God.
You
have no right to wear this sweater to school. On me, threw me against the wall. I mean, and I knew them. And then, and so when you get beat up by the people you know.
Wow.
You know, who you were friendly with, like Frederick Douglass, that we all got along. I didn't know I was a slave until I was about 9 because I played with the white kids, and then one day they told me, the point is, the illusion, when you think you're something and they tell you, let's be very clear, you're not, it shakes me to this day, but it's given me the gift of empathy, you know, and that's why I'm a revolutionary, because these people, you know, pardon me, we'll bleep that out, but these people. But, you know, it forces you, the only way to deal with, that's what Fanon said, the only way to deal with the internalized depression is through the fighting, through the aggression, because it's the aggression back, not particularly against white people, although that, nothing wrong with that, but against white society. You know, it's the fighting the white power structure that led so many black people to feel good about themselves, you know, during the 60s. And I'm just always thinking about how why people are so afraid of black anger.
Oh, yeah.
Which is why how Obama got elected, you know. Don't worry.
Because he was not angry.
I'm just really a nicest.
It didn't matter, did it? No. He still didn't like you.
No, didn't like him. Anyway.
It didn't matter at all. That's, which,
no, that's right.
The black people knew from day one what was going to happen. We knew it.
That's right. That's right.
It was just a matter of time.
Yep.
And he thought he could win over those Republicans.
They hated him.
From day one.
What was
it? Kind of sad to watch, really. And I sort of had PTSD watching Obama go through these, you know, he really felt, I think, and I've written about this, Obama, who's what I call the, you know, they call the Joshua generation, the black people born sort of during the civil rights movement, sort of the first inheritors.
That's right.
Okay, he really felt himself well positioned to be that bridge that could really carry everybody over, you know, because, you know, and there was some evidence of that. It seemed like, oh, maybe so. And so when he got elected, he immediately, you know, he thought, you know, he just used a charm offensive. He thought that he could win over Republicans. But what he didn't understand is that it's not just a political party. You're fighting the whole country.
Right.
It's the entire, you're taking on the whole history of the country. And, you know, I think Michael R. Dyson said, you know, he said, well, you know, if you can't like Obama, you can't like no Negro. You just can't like him because he was a central casting. He was smart and this and educated. But yet, ironically, because he was educated and he reached out, they hated him more for that. It's almost hated him more for his efforts to be inclusive than they did for him being angry, which he wasn't.
Yeah, but
that scared them more because he was actually trying to create unity. Oh, hell no.
Right,
that's something that frightens them because that changes everything, right?
Well, I think they were more frightened of Michelle.
Because they should be.
I know, that's what I'm saying, is that he was the good, she once, when he was elected, she said, for the first time, I'm proud of this country.
I thought they were supposed to be angry. That's
no, but they said, wait a minute, you weren't proud of it. For a moment, she slipped. You know what I mean?
She let down that mask.
She said, well, this is the first time I'm proud. And they said, wait, you were never proud before your husband? You don't like America? You know, so.
No surprise there.
Right, no surprise there, you know. And she, so.
Yeah, it was. That was another thing painful to watch. You knew what they were, you knew what she felt. I knew exactly what she was saying.
Right.
You knew what you wanted to say, but you had to watch it, you know, backtrack and button up. And, you know, it just reminded me of that Paul Laurence Dunbar poem, We Wear the Mask. And, of course, in politics, you always wear a mask of some kind. And it was just kind of like almost suffocating to watch them because you knew that they felt that you knew the truth, but they couldn't speak it. And the thing is, it didn't matter that they didn't speak it. They got demonized. They got, you know... They got labeled as socialists, which I wish they had been. Might as well, might as well have been socialists. Because trying to, the overtures just didn't work. And in fact, this led us straight to where we are now, right?
The voice you're hearing, the voices on the front lines, wake up and smell the revolution. So this is Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, who was married to, what's your husband's first name?
Oh, Alan.
Alan Kaplan, mm-hmm. Who was a teacher at?
Hamilton
High.
Mm-hmm.
Who stood up against racism.
He did.
And was vilified. Mm-hmm. You came in to do a story about him, and you must have liked him.
I always laugh when people always ask, how did you meet? And I'm like, oh, God. I gotta tell that story again.
It's a good story. That's what I'm asking.
Well, this seems like a million years ago, 1999, and we were still sort of living the aftermath of the civil unrest in L.A. But anyway, Alan was a teacher in the humanities magnet, and he taught American history, and he taught from the standpoint of, you know, this country was born in racism, and slavery is a big part of the history. You know, he said that this is what history was. He didn't see it as particularly controversial. He studied history and said, okay, this is what it is.
Right.
Now, this is the, you know, this was his approach to history. And the really ironic thing is, this approach did not upset the white people. It upset the black people, who felt that a white man, he was Jewish, a white Jewish man teaching the truth of American history was somehow wrong. somehow proprietary, somehow just, you know, racist, I guess? Anyway, it's a little hard to explain. But so for the whole time he was teaching, there was always these grumblings amongst Black people, and it was mostly because of the way he taught. He was very provocative. He would be in the classroom, which was, you know, a magnet, so it was white and Black. But he you know, always talked to the Black students. He said, you know, the white kids who perform well, they don't, you know, they're gonna be okay. But he wanted to really pull people in. So what he would say, for example, in front of the class, that statistically speaking, he said, you know, white people do better, you know, graduate high school, do this and do that, and have better outcomes than Black people. Now, why is that? So they have a discussion about that. The Black parents would then interpret that as, he's telling my kid he's going to fail. He's telling my kid that the odds are he's going to fail. So they would sort of personalize it, and it just built up all this resentment. And so eventually there was a campaign to get him and other people out of the magnet, and the whole campaign was, he's racist, he's a racist white man who's leading our kids astray. Now, so I went in to figure out what was going on, and the thing of it is, the parents who were leading this campaign, I knew them from other stories I'd done. They were good people, and I was inclined to believe what they were telling me. So, reporter, you know, you just kind of nod, okay, thank you, okay, and you just go in and figure out, you know, find out more. So the more I found out, the more I thought that there was much more to this story. But Alan Kaplan was hiding from the press, didn't want to talk. He felt he was under attack. So I had to convince him through other people to talk to me. That I said, you know, I would write a fair story. I didn't know what that story was. I couldn't promise anything.
Right.
So that's how I met him. He eventually agreed to meet me, and when he started talking about what he did and how he did it, I was kind of blown away. I thought, I wish I'd had a teacher like this when I was in high school. Not that he's a perfect person, and not that he didn't make mistakes, because I think the whole racial madness of this country makes it almost impossible for this to be smooth. For someone white to, you might know a little something about this, somebody white to sort of embrace, I guess, Black history or Black anything, and it looks suspicious. It looks, you know, it's not done. It's always in question. So, but that's how I met him, doing that story. And I came away with a very different idea than what the parents had been telling me.
Well, what's sad about that is that, those were conservative Black parents, and that there are a lot of Black parents who actually have supported Jewish teachers like me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is just really quick. I was a teacher in the public schools. I was a community organizer.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Black community, I lived in the Black community in Newark in 68. Mm-hmm. But you remember, 68 is not 99. So
right.
This is a revolutionary period in history. So all the white kids in Newark who came to organize were Jews, almost all of us.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in the community. We were welcomed into the community, and then I taught in the schools, taught in an all-Black school, and I started challenging everything, you know, and challenged that we had bad books, challenged the road education, challenged that I'm supposed to discipline the kids about how to eat lunch.
Mm.
I say, you know, I'm not a policeman, and I taught birth control because one of my kids was pregnant in eighth grade.
Mm.
They said they wanted to bring a guy from the Virginia. I had a Black conservative team teacher, and they said they want to bring in somebody from the Virginia Military Academy. I said, fine, I want to bring in Stokely Carmichael to talk. And I knew Stokely, so I was going to, anyway, I got fired.
Oh.
But the Black community rallied around me.
Wow.
And they said, he's the only one who actually believed in our students.
Wow.
He didn't want to do colonial education.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty beautiful. You know, the students rallied around me and said, he pushes me. Nobody else ever pushed me. Nobody, you know, one woman said to me, you know, my son is gifted, but you've brought out his genius.
Mm.
So what I'm saying is, I'm sorry about the teachers you had at UCLA, but he was a good guy. What I'm saying is, at a different point, black parents should have been mm-hmm. more rallying around him, and in a different context, they would have.
Well, that's the part of the interesting thing. Some black parents did rally.
Of course.
Kind of, but they were a little afraid of the protests had gotten so big. And wow. the thing is, the parents who were opposed to Allen and to some other, and they were generally against, they were also generally protesting magnet schools. They felt magnet schools, which were actually constructed to integrate schools, or at least keep part of the school integrated. Right. They felt they were just sort of these elite units within public schools that were keeping out regular students, etc. So Allen was part of that campaign. But the parents who led the campaign were actually, they were considered themselves quite progressive. They considered themselves, you know, liberal. They were not what I would call conservative. That's why it was interesting. But back then in 99, and I don't remember this well, but not every black person agreed maybe that it was good to center slavery. You know, there was some discussion I remember about, well, man, you know, we should, you know, there was ambivalence about it. There was ambivalence about it within the black community. You know, we need to accentuate the positive and, you know, that kind of thing. God. Yeah, that's what I think. But so you can call that conservative, but.
Yeah,
it is
conservative. Because having gone to Crenshaw, mm-hmm. it was a lot of those sort of black folks, the sort of pull up your pants and wear your pants right, and
oh yeah,
you know, don't talk about the negative, and I mean I didn't know very much as a student, but I knew that, you know, if Roots didn't come on TV, I probably wouldn't know about slavery. Yeah. So is that really what you're saying, that you want to have a whole, let me stop there before I say something inappropriate.
That's okay.
Yeah, keep going.
Sure. Are you trying to say that you'd want to have a whole revisionist history of the United States, right? Ooh, and so, you know, that, and I say that because the conversation that we're having with students is sort of reteaching that history as they're seeing that history repeat itself, right?
Right.
A lot of students, when we're talking about, for example, No Police, you know, they began the semester by saying, well, I don't see police on campus. And I told them, well, a lot of folks didn't think that Trump would get elected, but he did. Mm. And look, he's about to start bringing back Jim Crow. He's about to start bringing back the Black Codes. He's about to start bringing back everything you thought was already gone.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've moved them to, you know, because you have to teach history, right? You have to move them to say that if they did this just like 5 years ago, you don't think they're going to come back with the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to the story for one more thought.
Mm.
You know, the value of being trained as an organizer is that you see everything through a set of contradictions.
Mm.
So you see a white teacher. He's doing a lot of good things, but if you saw him, he's probably making some mistakes.
Mm.
So then you have the parents who are militant, but they don't want to talk about slavery. Well, that's something deep in the black community. There's this argument on that.
Mm-hmm.
And one argument is, I don't want to constantly be discussed out because you judge me through that lens. You know what I mean? I want that to go away.
Yeah.
And then the magnets. Well, there's a contradiction around the magnets. So the organizer comes in and says, all right, wait, everybody slow down. This is a contradiction. If you think Allen's making some mistake or the white teacher's making a mistake, let's talk about that. But are you saying he's not well-intentioned? Mm-hmm. Are you saying that he doesn't care about your children? Now, what are your concerns? Okay, let's talk about the Mac. You're trying to unravel a society that's falling apart, and you're trying to put it together to get everybody to say, okay, we really are on the same side.
Yeah.
Without organizers, all these contradictions are true.
Mm-hmm.
All the, you know,
yes,
what I mean, all
are.
The partial truths.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So everybody can be right because they see a piece of the puzzle that they feel very strongly about. And my job and organizer's job is to say, look, come on, man, the whole country is so anti-black.
Mm-hmm.
How do we work together?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't always work, but that's without that. There are so many contradictory forces pulling, you know, well, what about women? Okay, part about that. The women don't like this. And then what about gay people? You know, how come you didn't, you know, I've watched it unravel.
Mm.
Whereas in the 60s, I'm writing a book about this called We Made the Revolution with Our Bodies on the Line. I don't want to overstate it, but the gay movement saw itself at that time as the gay liberation movement, mm-hmm. as women's liberation movement. We had contradictions, but we were all against the war in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
We were all for civil rights. But within that, it was still rough. There's mm-hmm. no need to idealize that.
Sure.
So on a more personal level, so you did a story. That was a good story. You married the guy in the story.
Well, you know, I just hoped I was right about him. You know, I'm not an organizer, but I kind of felt like I should have been playing that role because I understood. Let me put it this way. I've always felt that black people have earned their paranoia.
Yeah.
Okay? I've heard people say some kind of crazy stuff. Like, I'm like, oh, really? You believe? But I understand why they go there.
Right.
Because, you know, the country's given us ample reason to suspect everybody. You know, I get that. I really do get that. My question was just, like, you know, the parents said, you know, he's awful and this and that, and we want best education for our kids. And I said, and when I started to find out things, I said, I went back to them and said, well, isn't he doing that? Isn't, and you know, and I talked to many students. There wasn't a student I talked to who didn't say, well, Mr. Kaplan helped me. You know, one guy said, I was nowhere. I was hanging out in the back of the class. I never expected anybody to talk to me or to treat me like I had a mind. All that, the things you described about what the kids said about you. But I couldn't, we didn't move them,
right.
You know? And that was what I thought was kind of tragic, that there was no movement. And it was personal. You know, Alan, there's something he could have done. He could have made it all go away by sort of being deferential, but he wouldn't do it. Because he had, you know, he was angry that he had been attacked. He felt, you know, personally attacked, and he was being personally attacked. But they made it a racial campaign against him, sort of his whiteness. And having taught this, he knew exactly what it was about. He knew more, better than that, what it was all about. But there was no, like you say, there was different truths, and there was no reconciliation of these truths. So yeah, so what I wrote was that I agreed with the campaign for equal education, you know, educational justice, absolutely. Is the way to do that firing Alan Kaplan? No, I don't think so. That was not, I had, and that's what I wrote. And that's, yeah, you know, the end of,
yeah.
The real end of the story.
Yes.
Yeah, I ended up marrying him. But that's not because, I thought he was a good teacher. It's a story you don't want to know. But I don't think the parents were very pleased about that. But that was totally unexpected. But I never encountered a white person like that. Remember I told you,
yeah.
I had great suspicion. I was ready to believe them because that's how we're all conditioned, right? So I was shocked to hear this sort of, you know, just to learn about him and to learn that he actually did, you know, actually taught real history. And I realized, oh my God, I think this is weird because I have not encountered this. So that said a lot about, it made me realize just how screwed up we are.
Well, everybody, we're going to move sort of to something else, but I want to stay with this for a minute. So that's the voice again of Aaron Aubrey Kaplan and how we got the last name Kaplan. You're in studio with Channing Martinez, the co-direct, co-host, co-partner with me on everything. Montalotti Walker, who's a really exciting new member of our team, and Aaron, who's been, you know, just a very original thinker like her dad, and part of the black intellectual tradition in the city, and a really good writer. And, you know, on Voices from the Frontline, sometimes we sort of say that we didn't create all these contradictions in America. You know, we're just trying to navigate them.
Mm.
And anybody who's been an organizer, I just want to say that that's the thing that I've learned so much is the multiple truths and how can you get everybody to say, all right, given these contradictions, can we agree to do something together?
Mm.
And when they do, that's the miracle.
Yeah.
It's not the norm.
It's
no,
not
no, it's not. The organizing people think, you know, the late Kikanza Ramsey, who just died, you know, of a one of the great organizers at the Strategy Center.
Wow.
You know, she's always say, you know, when you were in the 60s, you know, 100 people would come to your meetings and nobody showed up, only 2 people came. I said, honey, when the in the 60s, 4 people came, you know.
Really?
8, 10, but eventually, yes. Yeah. But when the when you're trying to get the a core of people to really want to work together, I'm telling you, it was 8. It wasn't 2. It wasn't 4. Mm. But it wasn't 23. Those 8 would have to go out into the community and build a different meeting for 22. Mm-hmm. Those 22, and then when, of course, the police shot somebody, million, you know, it felt like the whole community came out. Mm. But it's a long other story. But we had been the ones going door to door, talking to people all the time about police brutality. They knew us. They trusted us. And when the rebellion came, they came to us, and you know, mainly to our black members, by the way, our black leaders, and said, what do we do now? So the point of this is the role of the organizer, which is, to me, always the central question. Is the story you told is very tragic in a lot of ways. Mm. And Channing and Mortolotti are in the high schools today, dealing with different contradictions, but same ones. Mm-hmm. So you get what we call the last word. This can be on something totally random, something your favorite restaurant, something you pee off about, anything. It has to, no stream of consciousness. Okay. What's on your mind?
Oh, okay. I'm just going to go with that. Go with something that's on my mind. So you know I'm a dog. I'm an animal person.
Yes, you
amongst
are.
Other things. So I typically take my dogs, I've got 5, down to the cooler temperatures of El Segundo. I live in Inglewood, which is not very far drive, but it's a different community.
Yeah.
The last couple of weeks, a dog attacked us. It was a white guy across the street who had a dog, and the dog just got loose, but came and set up on my smaller dogs. It was he was aggressive, and I was very undone, and I kept, but the guy just stood there, didn't come get the dog, didn't call the dog's name, nothing. And fortunately, neighbors came out and helped, and he just sort of vanished. But I've been thinking about it ever since. I want to, you know, there was a black woman who lived on the block who told me afterward that was done on purpose. And I thought, oh my God, it's like Bull Connor in the 60s. Somebody actually unleashed a dog on me. You know, and again, I thought back to the aha moment I had in college where I didn't trust the white world anymore, but I realized that still felt outrageous to me. I was like, that can't be true. And I just want to meet this man. I want to encounter him. My people have told me, just stay out. Don't go there anymore. Mm-mm. Don't go there anymore. Clearly, and I thought, that is not the right response. I have the right to go there. But I think of that. I think if I saw this man, what would I say? And what could be, you know, what kind of conversation could we have? Even if he did unleash his dog on me, which I don't know for sure. But it was a scary moment, you know?
Well, think about your own psyche here. When you're 9, you go to your friend's house and you get attacked. When you're in college, you go see your white professor and you get attacked.
Mm-hmm.
When you mind your own business, a white man sticks a dog on you and it wasn't accidental. So think about that. You can run, but you can't hide. Huh?
Run, but you can't hide. Exactly.
Join the Strategy Center.
Even in 2024, we even talk about what's happening now. But it still felt like you can't do that. No, we have to talk.
Right.
You know.
Well,
I won't just take it.
No, please don't.
So.
And folks, that's why we're in South Central today. That's why we're at 3546, having a nice morning and. That's why you got to come to the Strategy and the Soul Movement Center to meet Channing and Mulati and Barbara and Acuna and me. And that's why we wake up in the morning, because you got to remember something. This is a white settler state, and that's what people don't want to acknowledge, that it's not America. As I say, it's U.S. fascist, genocidal, racist, imperialism, of the white settler state. And those are not epithets, those are scientific terms proven by your life just with your dogs. So even when you try to tell a nice story about your dogs, it ends up that the biggest dog is the white man.
Mm.
So how's that?
Yeah, It's unfortunate, but I still, the silver lining is I still have hope.
Oh yeah, we
you
do
know
too.
What I mean?
Oh, we do
I
too.
I don't leave it there.
No.
I went back to that neighborhood, and I still go back, and I look around, and I just kind of take ownership, and you know, so we'll.
All right. So the last thing you're gonna do, you got a new job. You're gonna be a backup singer in the
yes.
in the Strategy Center with the Strategistics. And we're going to sing some songs before we end up the show.
All right.
Any last thoughts, Jenny?
Y'all have fun with singing.
All right. Marilati, last thoughts.
I just wanted to thank you for that story. Mm. There was a lot of parallels between some of the experiences that you had mm-hmm. and I had in my life, and there's some things that I feel like I've suppressed or didn't, you know, I realized, oh, there was an aha moment that... Mm-hmm. Oh, that did happen to me, mm-hmm. or you just don't see it, or you just don't want to admit. So,
or you normalize it, or something like that, and yeah. Well, I'm sorry that those things happened to you, but I'm glad you know we connect on that.
Oh, absolutely.
Level,
thank you for that.
Oh, sure.
All right, folks, well, this is Revolutionary Therapy, and we're all, we're all trying to take care of each other. And that I want to end with actually something, because when Erin came in, she said something about, I want to get a copy of The Wretch of the Earth, and I've been reading it on, listening to it on Audible. And the reason why it's such a great book is because it talks about the psychotic nature of the oppressor and how the psychotic oppressor causes horrible pain to the oppressed, who then lose confidence in themselves. And the revolution is all about having these experiences and finding your own liberation, you know, finding your own validation. And you're all such wonderful people that thanks for coming.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It's been great. And way overdue, huh?
Yeah, we'll keep doing it.
We'll keep doing it.
All right. Everybody, welcome to Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show, Wake Up and Smell the Revolution. Like Channing Martinez said, the revolution is not free. KPFK is always, like its slogan is, we hanging by a thread.
Mm.
Because it's a very... it's an amazing institution. You have Michael Novick working as the station manager for nothing. Mm. You have layoffs of people. You have movements. And yet the station survives and thrives. So many of you out there in the community, I've had experience where I say hello to somebody and say, where have I heard that voice? Oh, yeah, Voices from the Frontlines. When Channing is out in the community, you know, every time, so many people say, thank you for Voices. So in return... Please call 818-985-5735. Give a vote of confidence to us, a vote of confidence to the station, because radio is a declining institution, and yet it's an essential institution, and we have to make it undecline, whatever that is. You know, there's no reason through podcasts, through your voices, through telling your friends, send an email to Channing at voicesfromthefrontlines.com, Eric at voicesfromthefrontlines.com. Say you listen to Erin Aubrey Kaplan, you listen to Marilati. Tell us something that you heard today, and please send money to the station, because it's a wonderful station. We're honored that we can be in South Central Los Angeles and be part of kpfk.org. So, you know, I've been singing along with Jerry Butler, singing my own songs. But my dream was always have a group called the Strategistics. So today is the first day of the new group. And this is Marilati Walker and Erin Aubrey Kaplan and Eric Mann. And we're going to sing our good song, What Becomes of the Broken Hearted by Jimmy Ruffin. And if you want to be part of the Stylistics and the strategistics, just stand up and sing. Come on, it's in the morning, just jump out. You know the song. Mm. Sing along with us. Let's do this.
Dreams. I have visions of many things, but happiness is just an illusion filled with sadness and confusion. What becomes of a broken-hearted who has loved us now departed? I know I've got to find some kind of peace of mind, maybe. The roots of love grow all around, but for me they come tumbling down. Every day heartaches grow a little stronger. I can't stand this pain much longer. I walk in shadows, searching for light. Cold and alone, no comfort inside. Hoping and praying for someone who cares. Always moving and going nowhere. What becomes of a broken-hearted who has loved that now departed? I know I got to find some kind of peace of mind. Help me, please. I'm searching though I don't succeed. For someone's love there's a growing need. All is lost, there's no place for beginning. All that's left is an unhappy ending. Now what becomes of the broken-hearted who has love that's now departed? I know I got to find some kind of peace of mind. I've been searching everywhere just to find someone who cares. I've been looking every day, know I'm gonna find a way. Nothing's gonna stop me now, I'll find a way somehow. I'll be searching everywhere just to find someone who cares.
So hey everybody, you're on Voices from the Frontlines. We already know you're going to give money to KPFK, 90.7 FM and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We know you're going to write to us, please, 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 at Eric at Voices from the Frontlines, Channing at Voices from the Frontlines. You can put them both on one email. We are capable of talking to each other. And just a small segment, I'm going to talk to Channing Martinez, who I talk to all the time. I'll talk about food. What's that plan you're on now? Did you get the meals and get the recipes?
Yeah, I'm still kind of on it.
You can say the name of it, though.
Yeah, if I remember the name. I always got to go to the app now. But it's called HelloFresh, and it's a weekly delivery of foods.
What do you think of it so far?
I think it's mainly based on a pretty basic, you know, American-esque diet. I see that they are diversifying. There's a few Indian recipes and maybe a Greek recipe there, but, you know, especially because I'm vegetarian,
right?
They have very limited options. So I think I've gone through all 15 of their vegetarian options, and I'm like, I'm tired of eating this now.
All right, so you're breaking with the program.
I might be breaking with the program.
Okay. Well, you're a good cook. What's your favorite meal that you make yourself? You make a lot of good stews and soups.
Yeah, so for years I liked panadas, which is a Belgian Garifuna food, and it's almost like an empanada. It's made out of corn, and it's stuffed with either beans or tuna.
We had those because
this year me and my aunt decided we're going to learn how to cook a lot of our own cultural food. So we looked up the recipe, and we came together every Sunday during Black History Month, and we learned how to cook a recipe each weekend.
Yeah, well, you, me, and Akuna had a great time with it, so please do it again. seriously, that was really good. And tell us, what was that thing we had today, that bread ball?
Oh, festival bread. I think that is Jamaican, and basically it's like a donut. It's right. Fried dough.
Yeah. And what's the restaurant we go to in Leimert?
Aki Bamboo.
That place is unbelievable. It's one of my all-time favorites. They have jerk chicken. They have great fish. They have, what was that thing they had? Oxtails.
Yeah.
Oxtails, oh my God. And they give a lot of cabbage and then terrific rice. Oh, let's go now. I remind myself I got to go soon. Tell me other restaurants you like.
Well, obviously, I go to Earl's on Crenshaw a lot because I like them a lot. Orleans and York. And actually, it's sort of awkward. I tend to have my restaurants in different areas. So if I'm on my way or in a certain part of town, I already know I'm there. That's where I'm going. So like in downtown, I go to LA Cafe because they have this really unhealthy but really tasty lobster panini that I get every time I go there.
Well, how much time we got on? We just talked about it. 1 minute. So Earl's, we used to be called Earl's Grill, it's now called Earl's on Crenshaw. Carrie Earl's a good friend of ours. And I love the jumbo kosher dog. And I've been used to, and also the fish, what is that, fish burger?
Oh, the salmon burger.
Salmon burger, oh my God. So you got to go to Carrie's on Crenshaw. Got to go to, I don't want to get the Aki
Bamboo.
Aki Bamboo in Leimert. And you got to go to Channing Martinez's special place, but he ain't going to tell you where to get there. So with this, it's Voices from the Front Lines. Me and Channing, as always. And we'll see you next week, Friday at 7. Take good care of yourselves.
Regrets. I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do and saw it through without exemption.